Hi everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of Soulful, the podcast that reveals everything you ever wanted to know about sneakers, hosted by me, Jason Coles, and the always magnificent Kish Cash. So Kish, this is the second episode of our two-part Adidas special. I mean, we had a great chat, didn't we, with the shoes creator Chris Severn about the early days
what
of the shoe.
What a dude.
Wasn't he?
What a dude, right?
Amazing
84
guy.
Years of age, and he's still about it, and he's so enthusiastic. The passion that he has,
absolutely,
you know, for his history and the brand and the shoe, etc., just like permeated through.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
So today, today we're going to be kind of picking up the story from where Chris left off. Who are we talking today? Who's on the show? Who's going to be?
There's only one chap, really, isn't there? He's the world's preeminent authoritarian on sneaker history, and we have to talk to Dr. Thomas Turner, PhD. I'm just trying to think: do we call him Tom? Do we call him Thomas, or do we refer to him every time we chat to him, Dr. Thomas, PhD?
I think it's got to be like that, hasn't it? It's got to be Dr. Thomas.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, if he doesn't know, as we've said before, it didn't happen. Basically, you know, it's all down to him, you know, and to see his, you know, analysis and his anecdotes and, you know, all the stories that he can regale about this shoe, it's going to be a fascinating one for sure.
Exactly. I mean, to give you an idea of just how much love Thomas has for the superstar, you know, he actually gives lectures as part of his social history course. Yeah, when he teaches at the London School of Fashion, one of his most popular courses apparently is the one on the superstar.
Do you think he knows more than Chris himself
in terms of the modern day stuff? So everything kind of post Chris. I would not be surprised if he actually does, although I wouldn't tell Chris that.
No, of course not. We'll keep that between ourselves, definitely. Wicked. Well, let's get to it then, okay? Let's step up to Dr. Thomas Turner, PhD.
So, Thomas, welcome back to Soulful. Great to have you on again. Before we dive in with you, just to do a little scene setting, we had a fantastic interview with Chris Severn, the father of the superstar, and he took us through the early days of the shoe, its development and how it conquered basketball. But we know that that's only the beginning of the superstar story, isn't it? So let's start off with, you know, how did the superstar first make that jump from being a very pro-level basketball shoe to becoming a street fashion icon?
The thing about it is because it's a pro-level basketball shoe, it becomes desirable on the street at the same time as it being a pro-level shoe. So there are some people who've got the wherewithal or the contacts or the money who can get it, particularly in the States, particularly in New York. Mm-hmm. It becomes like a fashion shoe. So that's in the 70s. But it's a sort of a niche thing because not many people can get it. And it's quite hard to find. I think the big change
sorry to interrupt. Does that actually add to the allure of the shoe? Because the thing is, from what I've noticed on the street, something that's unattainable is more desirable.
Yeah, definitely. So it becomes something that just a handful of people have. And if you've got it, it's pretty, you know, cool. Mm. The big change, though, happens when it moves out of high-level basketball. So that's in 79 when the Top 10 comes out, which is this sort of next-level elite shoe, if you like. That's the one that the NBA players would be wearing. Right. And at the same time, Adidas changes their distribution kind of network. So in the 70s, they were only really available in sports shops. Mm. So if you had to go to a sporting goods store, that's where you'd get them. In the United States, it was a bit difficult to get them because their distribution wasn't amazing. In the 70s, or during the 70s and toward the end of the 70s, that really improves. And you start being able to buy them much more widely and much more readily. So you can go into a shop and you can just buy a pair of Adidas. The thing that happens with the Superstar is that because they've got the Top 10 has come out, and that's the elite shoe, the Superstar kind of shifts a little bit down the kind of hierarchy of products and becomes something that's used as more of a gym shoe or a high school shoe.
Right.
And that's when it starts to become really, really popular as a street shoe. So you see kids in New York. It's got this connection to basketball and, you know, particularly African-American kind of sports icons who are playing in the basketball leagues. And that filters down and makes it become kind of desirable and fashionable among young kids in the same way that happens with football boots or something.
What I was going to say is, you know, you're having a kick about in the street and some of the shoes that, you know, iconic shoes, you know, from the 70s and 80s that you'd play, you know, in the playground, you know, it's a similar sort of thing with that, isn't it?
It's the ones you want, the like kids just, there's this connection between, you know, whether it's the Converse All-Star or whether it's a Puma Clyde or that kind of stuff. Like the shoes that you see your heroes wearing on television are the ones you want as kids. I mean, we remember that as kids anyway, right? You know, you remember, name a football star or an athlete or somebody that you remember seeing and you wanted their shoes. That's like the whole thing with Michael Jordan, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah.
So you have that going on with the Adidas Superstar through the 70s. Then when it becomes more available, it just becomes something that gets picked up. And I think it becomes like a fashion in New York City in the very early 80s. So it's something that just kids in high school are wearing, kids in middle school are wearing. And that's where it starts to develop this kind of connection. Now, the important thing that's the important thing that's happening is that hip hop is developing at that time as well. So you've got in the sort of the South Bronx, the outer boroughs of New York City, you've got, you know, like the first kind of spur sort of development of hip hop. The parties happening, the DJs, the, you know, that kind of stuff, the tapes going round. And you, it's associated very much with those early days of hip hop because it's what people were wearing. Just, you know, that was the fashion at the time.
And then the mad thing, one of the sort of iconic key moments, I think, within not just, you know, sneaker culture, sneaker history, but more in terms of even marketing, etc., was the fact that Run DMC came into the mix, you know, the biggest rap group of the time, and they were championing these shoes, weren't they?
They would, oh well, obviously they had a song called My Adidas.
Yeah.
Of course they were.
But the thing is, that happened a little bit after, didn't it? You know, the thing is, you know, when they first came out, they were still wearing the shell toes in their imagery.
Yeah, they were. The thing I think is interesting is that if you look back at it, if you go back and you sort of trace this history, you've got that very first wave of, you know, like first wave of hip hop that comes out. So things like the Rocksteady Crew, the tracks put out by Malcolm McLaren with, like, you know, from artists with New York.
That's it, Buffalo Girls and
Buffalo Girls, yeah, Double Dutch yeah, the Duck Rock album, the videos that are associated with that.
That stuff's
coming out in 82, 83, which is when shell toes, superstars are kind of fashionable in New York. And so that is, you know, you see on the cover of the Rocksteady 12 inches, they've got these, you know, cartoon graphics drawn by, you know, graffiti artists that...
By Doze.
Like they've got the shell toes and the Puma Clydes on. So that's, that spreads out around the world and that kind of carries this fashion to a wider audience. You've got that sort of... before Run DMC happened. So this is like the very, you know, like 82, 83, that... superstars are becoming associated with hip-hop already. And you've got stuff like in the background of things like Graffiti Rock. There's a moment
Michael Holman,
TV program, where they're talking about, they say, tell us about your fashion. And the bit that he talks about, the kids are both wearing, Rosemary and Dino, they're both wearing superstars.
I remember
that's
that.
It. That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
And the thing is, it would be something that would be replicated a few years later in the UK as Dance Energy going on, you know, late 80s, early 90s with Normski in the form.
You're holding
that role.
So this is like all of this stuff that's happening in the very early 80s. The background of, you know, Subway Art, Martha Cooper's and Henry Chalfont's book, there's pictures of people wearing superstars in that. It's getting these kind of connections to this New York street culture. And as that New York street culture is being spread around the world, there's people who are picking it up, maybe in the UK, who perhaps, you know, leafing through something like Subway Art or watching a dodgy VHS copy of like Wild Style or Graffiti Rock.
Yeah, I remember those days.
They're seeing superstars and thinking, oh, yeah, I want to look like, I'm into this new hip-hop thing.
You wanted to emulate your heroes, basically. At the end of the day, you see these iconic figures, these cultural figures, I should say, before they became iconic figures, and you're just like, yo, they're cool. They look fresh. So we want to, you know, we want to be down with that. And it was all about being down with a certain sort of tribe, a certain sort of look back then, from what I recall.
Yeah,
and how did a sports brand become such a big part of that whole hip hop look? Because that whole, you know, that the whole tracksuit and trainers look. How did that first kind of, you know, become part of the fabric of hip hop?
Oh, I mean, I think it's because if you look at hip hop, it's created by kids. I mean, it's like really, really young kids who basically can't get into some of the top venues, and they're sort of creating their own culture. You know, away from sort of mainstream culture. The fact is that kids were wearing sneakers and sports shoes way, way back. Like, kids have been wearing sneakers in America since the 20s. And just the models that they wanted had changed and shifted. You've also got, at the same time, this the sort of explosion in casual fashion or, you know, informal clothing that's happening after the Second World War. And you've got a lot of brands that are making clothes and selling clothes, and people are wearing clothes that are less formal than they were previously.
It's also easier to wear. They're cheaper. They're also... It's loungewear, isn't it? It's sportswear. Yeah. It's just casual. It's just cool. It's just relaxed. It's loose.
It's cool.
And the other thing is you can play sports in them, and you can also dance in them as well. So I suppose, you know, you could
it's comfortable, it's practical, all that kind of stuff. I think the big thing, though, that that often gets missed is the connection between basketball and hip-hop.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like if you watch something like Wildstyle, there's that great big segment in the middle of it where they're playing basketball. Like, there's a whole sort of court battle thing.
It's the street sport of New York, isn't it, at the end of it? It's their equivalent of football.
Exactly. It's the street sport of New York. It's really kind of important there. A lot of the particularly, you know, people from outer boroughs, like the African-American players particularly, were coming from New York. So you've got this sort of connection to local heroes, local kind of icons, that sort of thing happening. And let's not forget, a lot of these sort of parties were kind of taking place, so the legend says anyway, on like public courts and basketball courts, like people hooking up to the local lamppost, getting the turntables on, and then having a big party. Herc was playing in gymnasiums and stuff.
Yeah.
So there's a connection to sport going on there as well. So I think there's a sort of interweaving thing between sport and the music development and the cultural development of hip-hop at that time.
Well, that's true. And it sort of leads us to the question of, you know, when did Run DMC and their association with Adidas come into play?
Right, I think.
And how did that develop?
Well, Run DMC, I think they're quite interesting when they come out. I mean, you'll know this, Kish, because of, you know, they come out and they sort of come out in, what, 83, 84?
Yeah.
And they're sort of the second wave, really, of hip-hop. Because you've got this, the very early stuff has happened. And those very first artists are all associated with, like, you know, crazy funkadelic style outfits, aren't they?
Yeah, sort of stage outfits, very exuberant, very, very, you know, out there, as you say, like, very expressive. Yeah. You know, you wouldn't be
had all the guys like Afrika Bambaataa with his crazy outfits and, you know, even Grandmaster Flash to an extent.
Exactly.
That's right. And I think that sort of represented sort of the disco era and the sort of flamboyance of that, and where, you know, some aspects of that, you know, permeated into within hip hop. The key thing is that when Run DMC came out, everything prior to that became regarded as old school. Yeah. And that's where the term comes from. It's because, you know, Run DMC, you know, they were the new school. They were the new school wave. So everything else prior to that is old school in terms of look, in terms of sound, in terms of where they rhymed, and the whole attitude, etc. It's crazy.
Exactly. But the thing about them, though, when they come out, is that they are saying, with their connection with Adidas, and particularly with them wearing the Superstar, they are saying, look, we come from New York street culture. We are rooted in the, you know, hip-hop. And we go back to those early days. It's a sort of symbolic thing, I think, that they when they wear that, they're very deliberately wearing the clothes that a sort of street kid would be wearing.
Yeah,
and they're taking that into, you know, onto the stage. And they're unusual in that they do that. So when they perform on Graffiti Rock, and they kind of look very similar to the audience, basically. They're not like, you know, there's the other rappers on there, like Kool Moe Dee is on there, and he's all kind of dressed up. Whereas Run DMC are much more street. So it's something about saying, look, we're authentic, we're real, we come from the streets. This is where we're from. The other thing I think about the why they have the Adidas is, and I'm, you know, like, I can't really prove this or anything, but I think this is a sort of canny move by, you know, by the manager, getting them all to dress up in the Adidas and the matching sort of suits and everything. It makes them memorable, and it gives the audience something that they can copy and they can wear to show their sort of affinity with them.
Right.
So it's a bit like...
Which is an old trick.
I put this in the book.
Yeah.
It's an old trick.
Yeah.
It's like the Bay City Rollers with their tartan.
Yeah. Or even the Beatles. I mean, people used to dress up like the Beatles.
Kind of finding an identity for yourself as a group to make yourself memorable, so that when people see you, you would say, like, oh, yeah, those are the guys that dress up in the Adidas suits and with the Adidas sneakers on.
Yeah.
We know who they are.
Yeah, but the commercial aspect wasn't apparent, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it hadn't been in the same... If they were doing that now, the first thing you would do would be you'd be on the phone to a number of sports brands saying, like, hey, we've got this band, we want to... You know, we're maybe going to dress in your clothes.
Yeah.
Whereas I think then it was just like, hey, let's dress in the street stuff, and we'll all wear these suits, and that's it'll be memorable.
Yeah, totally.
Part of that identity was the whole laceless thing, and I've heard lots of different stories Thomas, and Kish, you probably heard lots too.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the true story behind that? I've heard everything from kind of wearing it as an homage to people, you know, who couldn't wear laces in prison. Mm. What's the true story?
I'm sort of as baffled as you really as to what the real true story is. The story I've heard is that it's exactly that. It's that guys who would wear them in jail would wear them without laces because they weren't allowed the laces because they might, hang themselves or something with it, I suppose. And that then when they came out of jail, they would continue to wear the sneakers without laces as a sort of statement of how tough they were.
But also because their brain conditioning as well would be that's what they're used to, and they'd just walk out the street, not even giving it a second thought as well.
Yeah.
And that this was something that Run DMC, particularly Jam Master Jay, was sort of copying as this kind of, hey, we're going to dress like the sort of tough street guys. Well,
the thing is, Jam Master Jay was the most hood out of the three, wasn't he? And he had so many connections to the sort of New York underworld, as it were, from that. And
I heard a story about Jam Master Jay that he kind of explained it slightly differently. He said that it's got nothing to do with the whole prison thing.
Mm.
It's just that I used to like matching my laces to my T-shirt. So if I was wearing a pink T-shirt, I used to wear pink laces. But he said, I got so fed up of changing my laces every day, I just didn't bother lacing them. Now, maybe that's not as kind of glamorous as the prison one, but it kind of explains a few things.
But that shows you how clever they are when they're marketing. Everyone has this story. It's like, they're rough and tough, they're copying the street hoodlums.
That's it.
When actually it was just because he was lazy.
Or that was just a cover story so he didn't get asked, difficult questions.
Yeah, maybe.
Alluding to, the people that he was sort of rolling with, which unfortunately, was one of the reasons of his demise, actually, unfortunately, which is really sad. And it's,
still unsolved as well. Yeah,
still unsolved.
Crazy.
Yeah, still unsolved. But the thing is, Run DMC, I'm really interested to know if Run DMC had chosen to do Puma.
Yeah, I know.
Right? Do you know what I mean? Because Nike wasn't really the thing, back then.
Not back then.
No, and nor was Reebok. It was basically just Adidas was dominant. But the thing is, Puma was the number two, really, in some respects. Yeah. Imagine if they'd done the sort of Puma move and how the landscape would have differed in its entirety.
I know. They would have lost a syllable in the song, wouldn't they?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But Puma, they were kind of the choice of all the B-boys, though, weren't they? I mean, everyone seemed to be wearing Clydes at that time. I know there were lots of other brands, but the stories that you hear is that, you weren't a proper B-boy unless you were wearing Clydes.
I think it just seems that there's like all the shoes that were the most desirable ones were ones that were associated with top basketball players, apart from, say, like Nike Oceanas or something like that. Basically, there were Proked 69ers, Puma Clydes, and Adidas Sheltos, and Adidas Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's, which is one that's often sort of, overlooked, which was really important in New York because he comes from New York.
A model that was down from the superstar as well, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
It was a cheaper shoe that was more, easier to get hold of, I suppose, or easier for your mum to buy you a pair.
That's right.
Yeah, and when you look at a lot of those old pictures of people people in New York in the sort of early 80s, a lot of them are, like, these kids are wearing Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's rather than superstars.
I mean, the whole aesthetic of that shoe, sort of lends itself, to sort of a casual sort of look.
Well, I think that's one of the things why, say, the Puma's become really popular, is that they are, because they're brightly coloured in suede, and Puma are quite clever in doing that, in releasing them in, ostensibly because it's to match with team uniforms, but really it's because they're a casual shoe. It means that it gets picked up by this sort of style, and it means you can, like what we'd see now, like the way trainers are this kind of way into fashion, particularly for young men who wouldn't otherwise engage with fashion. It's a way of like matching your shoes to your outfit. It's a way of like wearing something brightly coloured. There's all that going on. And so when you're developing hip hop style, I think it really fits with that.
Yeah,
really
match up games are definitely a prominent look, and still to this day. Going to the Run DMC Association, though, we're always going to associate Run DMC and Superstar and Sheltos together, obviously, for many reasons. So the thing is, when did this next step? I mean, I know this story, but I want you to tell it because our listeners might not be familiar with this. I see. That's the thing, Thomas. So, when it comes to Run DMC, Adidas, what was that moment? What was that spark where it just went like that and it happened?
When it went boom. Oh, come on. Yeah. That's when they released my Adidas, really.
Mm. Yeah.
Everyone knows that, hip hop fans were watching them wearing seeing them wearing Adidas clothes for like 3 years before that, and sporting goods and you know, shoe shops were picking up on this and like getting them, you know, selling it as like, hey, these are the Run DMC shoes. So that's, you know, that was all happening. But
yeah,
there's this.
But that song, Thomas, it wasn't just like a song about their love of Adidas, was it? It was they actually made it for another reason, wasn't it? It was almost like a reaction to someone else's song.
It's a reaction to the Dr. D's Felon Sneakers song,
right?
Like where he was saying, you know, that if you're wearing trainers, you're a stick-up kid, and you need to be more sensible. And it's a bit of a kind of takedown on the sort of b-boy. It's also a reaction against Adidas actually slipping from its place at the sort of pinnacle of hip-hop fashion. So it comes out after the Nike Air Jordan 1 has come out and has sort of usurped it as the shoe that becomes the most desirable one. And in the same way, I think of them saying, wearing Adidas at the beginning, saying that this is like we're from the street and showing their authenticity, it's again like restating that and saying, look, we're not going to change. We are like, we're down with the street. That's where we come from. These are our roots. And if you read the lyrics, or you listen to the lyrics of the song, it's kind of like the shoe is a stand-in for them. Like it's their, the shoe is them, really. So they're talking about Adidas, like my Adidas. Like my Adidas, we were on stage, we played at Live Aid, like all that kind of stuff. That's them sort of talking about the experience that they've had over the past 3-4 years, being these, like going from being kids in Queens to becoming like international superstars, basically playing around the world. And the way that they use the Adidas is actually as a sort of metaphor for themselves. So it's like, it stands in for them. Adidas had gone to see them play at Madison Square Garden. I think, you know, like, I mean, come on, like the shoe my Adidas, I think as well as it being like all this, you know, blah, 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 it's about themselves and everything. Mm. I mean, it's kind of them saying, look, come on, Adidas, we've made you loads of money.
Yeah.
And we're not seeing any of this.
That's right. That's
show us the damn money.
Yeah. That's what they're saying.
Yeah. Show me the money. Yeah, definitely. So, you know, the thing is, I mean, because, you know, as you said, the Air Jordan 1 had come out, then boom, they come out with all this and they're just going, but they actually made the superstar, I would say, the number one street shoe in New York, maybe beyond New York.
Again, they sort of just, they revive it in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, the story about the concert is what? So they play this concert at Madison Square Garden. Mm. It's like their homecoming show. They're the biggest stars on, you know, some of the biggest stars on the planet at that point.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, huge, great thing. There's a Adidas representatives there, a guy called Angelo Anastasio, who is watching this, and Run DMC, when they play My Adidas, are like, throw your sneakers in the air, everybody.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, everybody in the audience throws their sneakers in the air, like, you know, holds their sneakers aloft. And
crazy.
The guys from Adidas are like, oh my God.
Yeah.
We don't see this at the Olympics.
No,
kind of no, exactly. When you see photos of that concert and you just see this kind of like sea of superstars, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I don't think that's ever been replicated to that extent, ever.
I sort of want to see what, you know, like how did everyone pop them off their feet? I mean, I guess because they all had fat laces and didn't
or
have them
they
tied
didn't,
up.
Or they didn't have laces, do you know what I mean? They popped them off their feet like that, you know. But the thing is, you wore, you know, generally the hip-hop style back then, and for me, I still, you know, I still haven't left it, is you just wear your shoes pretty wide, loose, you know what I mean? Just
keep your laces loose.
Yeah.
Exactly. As Sneaker Fika tells us.
Yeah, exactly, you know. So maybe it's, you know, it's easier to pop things off your feet, I guess, you know what I mean? But the thing is, that moment, though, led to something which is still reverberating through the industry and through the music industry and through the sneaker industry and through the fashion industry, even to this day.
Yeah, definitely. I think what it leads to, I mean, in sort of practical terms, is it leads to Adidas signing this million-dollar deal with Run DMC, and Run DMC start endorsing Adidas.
Non-athletes.
So they're non-athletes. Yeah. So it's one of these first moments where a brand which is closely associated with sports sort of replicates the endorsement model which had been developing through the 60s and 70s with a non-sports star.
Yeah.
And so you have Run DMC kind of on TV advertising, you know, Adidas stuff. You have a line of Adidas shoes that are brought out and clothes in association with Run DMC. You see Adidas supporting Run DMC tours and all that kind of stuff. So they're connected up, and you have this deal, which is, as you say, this is something that we see all the time now. So there is these collaborations between stars from wider culture. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that is sort of missed a lot in this is that actually Adidas were sort of courting pop stars and, you know, people from the sort of music industry and the mm-hmm. film industry around this time. So if you look, if you go to the Adidas archive, as I have been, you can look through stuff like these magazines and sort of publications that they produce. And there's one called, where they had this little subsection called Adidas Pop, where they had photographs of all, like, you know, Tina Turner or David Lee Roth or, you know, 80s, you know, whoever, Europe, stuff like that. And they have them wearing Adidas shoes, probably because they'd sent them a pair of shoes or because they'd, like, started wearing them. But you didn't have this... I mean, so that kind of stuff was going on.
Yeah, Nike were doing similar things. They had Elton John shoes, etc.
They were aware of the importance of that sort of stuff happening. They weren't kind of totally ignorant to the fact that people were wearing their shoes for non-sporting purposes, and they weren't ignorant of the fact that if you can get a famous pop star or a famous film star in your shoes, that has an influence on sales.
Despite the official line, we're a sporting goods company.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because then you had people like Sly Stallone, you know, wearing them in the Rocky films. And I think, you know, one of those iconic images from Live Aid is Freddie Mercury wearing a pair of Adidas Hercules. Yeah.
Mm. Exactly. So you have that stuff is all happening. But they haven't yet sort of turned it into a real sort of commercial.
They haven't formalised it, have they? No.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that really shifts, and that's the move that is something different there.
We're looking at something then, which we now look at the equivalent on the level of in proportion is, you know, Kanye West and Yeezy again with Adidas.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, I mean it sows the seeds for all of that sort of stuff.
Footwear line, apparel line, the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the other thing as well is that, you know, we talk about when did the superstar become a street shoe, and you say, oh, well, it sort of really becomes a street shoe when the top 10 comes out in 79. So it's moved down the hierarchy. It's no longer like, they're no longer bothered about having it being seen as a top model, if you like.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
By the time Run DMC come along, by the time that deal is signed in 87, it's a shoe that's, you know, like nearly 20 years old. It's like completely obsolete from a sports purpose. Like if you look at the basketball boots that are being, or the basketball shoes that are being made around that time, it's like, you know, way, way behind. Like it's outdated. It's archaic. Not really worn by anyone. Seriously.
Mm.
For Adidas, it's actually like a way of eking out sales of a model which they've got all of the expertise. They've got, you know, if you look at it in terms of how it's produced, they've got the factory set up, all the people who are stitching it together in the factories in France, they know how to make it, they've got all the knives that stamp out all the pieces, they've got the molds for the soles, all that sort of stuff. All of that's really well established, so they don't actually have to invest anything new in it. And the Adidas connection allows them to get a bit more sales out of something which otherwise might have just, you know, like street fashions were changing, Adidas wasn't as popular anymore, perhaps. Like,
generally, you had to be wearing the latest stuff. This is the latest cool thing, and that's what gave you cool points. But this bucked the trend. It was a remarkable sort of feat that happened, and it's something we take for granted right now.
Yeah.
But the mad thing is, it came out of something that shouldn't have really happened from Adidas's history, really. Who would have predicted? It would have been good to have seen Adidas's reaction. Because I think, am I right, Jace, the company had been sold?
Not just yet, but it was kind of at that period where they were, they'd basically been stomped on by both Nike and Reebok.
Mm.
So that, you know, entertainment and music was a really good way for them to kind of fight back, basically.
Thing you see in some of these publications, that they're really just kind of baffled by hip hop and New York street culture. So like, the guys in Huts on Arak, you know, they're just like, what is this? There's one that they put out. It's called like, what is rap? And it has this like, description of it. It's like, you know, people talking over beats or something.
Yeah, that's it. How did Run DMC and their management convince Adidas to stump up this money? Go, yo, this is our value. Show us the money, as Jace said.
I mean, I think it's by them saying, come on, they've got Madison Square Garden full of people wearing their shoes.
Yeah.
And they're the biggest selling rap group on the planet. They've been on the cover of Rolling Stone. They're played at Live Aid. They played them. They're a big deal at that point. They're at the pinnacle really of their success at that point. So for Adidas, it seems like a really good deal, and it is, because it generates a lot of income for them, and it prolongs the life of a shoe which otherwise might have kind of disappeared. And I think probably like that shoe wouldn't have the cultural connection and the cultural value that it has today were it not for that. So, you know, Superstar is still an important shoe, if you like, and it's still a really, really big seller for Adidas.
That's it.
But that the connection to Run DMC, and before that the connection to hip hop, is what really allows that to happen.
It still, as Kish said, it still resonates, because you've got young kids now who you may have never even heard of Run DMC, but they know of the connection to the Superstar, don't they?
But that's because, I mean, that's because it takes on this other life. So it's, I mean, if you sort of what you're saying about the Adidas being in trouble, perhaps at the end of the 80s, it's sort of they have to look back almost and find anything that they can to make money. And one of the things that they can do is this selling old models and kind of initiating the whole old school kind of style, the old like retro fashion thing, builds on the fact that people were already kind of looking for early 80s sneakers anyway, and it had become like a high kind of cool thing to have them. But Adidas start buying into that and pushing their older shoes, and one of them is the Superstar, and that gives it this other life where it becomes a kind of retro style sneaker, where you've got sneaker design has gone crazy in the 90s, and there's all sorts of wild stuff happening with all the other brands and with Adidas as well. But for a lot of people, that stuff is just too sort of noisy, it's too over the top,
right?
And people like, well, that jumping old,
yeah, jumping forward a bit to the 90s, the shoe kind of had a bit of an upgrade, didn't it? Because then you got the Superstar 2 coming along. What was different about the Superstar 2?
Superstar 2, there's not an awful lot that's really different. It's just a bit puffier. It's got, you know, a bit more padding in it, a thicker tongue. The shape of the last that it's made on, I think, is ever so slightly different. And you see all sorts of different toe box, the rubber shell that goes on the toe. So it's that the shape of that changes slightly as well.
But that became really popular with skaters, didn't it? Because, as you say, with that kind of extra padding and the fact that it had this, you know, the toe protection, just made it almost like a great, you know, it's almost like designed for skating in some respects.
Well, I think it's the sort of connection with skateboarding is because it's a shoe that's relatively inexpensive at that point. And in the early 90s, there's this whole very technical street skating kind of becomes the dominant sort of style, if you like.
Right.
Which is about very intricate tricks and, you know, flipping your board around and doing all sorts of stuff, known as the big trousers, small wheels era.
Okay.
And to do these like very intricate tricks, to wear kind of high top or kind of like quite bulky shoes, which had been the style in skateboarding previously. So you'd have shoes which were kind of much more similar to, say, a basketball high top from the 80s. People started wearing, first was people started slicing down their shoes and wearing lower cut versions of high top basketball type shoes. But they also started wearing these low cut kind of old fashioned basketball sneakers, which had a flat sole, which was really good for skating. So things like the Puma Clyde, Converse All-Stars as well, and the Adidas Superstar, they become popular because they allow you to do these tricks. They allow you to move your feet in a way that perhaps if you're wearing a high top that had a kind of more of a more substantial ankle, that wouldn't work.
Did the Adidas Run DMC version of the Superstar, the Ultrastar, also have an effect on leading to the development of the Superstar 2?
I guess so. I haven't ever thought of that. I suppose it must have done. Yeah, like, because that's got a padded tongue, hasn't it?
And padded tongue, bit elasticated, so it's, you know, you can wear them laceless.
Yeah.
Didn't they have a version that had a double tongue?
God, that sounds awful.
the double tongue I think might have been a Jeremy Scott though later on. Jeremy Scott and his Maverick sort of shenanigans within the sort of
slightly expressive out there stuff,
expressive fashion things that he does.
I think that's what you've got going on in the 90s. So you've got the skateboarding thing with kind of guys wearing it and liking it because it's sort of simple and quite basic, and it allows them to kind of skate in the way that they want to skate, and so it enables them to do that sort of, you know, very intricate form of skating that's popular. At the same time as well, you've got people selling old ones, you know, like dead stock or secondhand ones. So you've got the whole rise of the retro style. So you see secondhand markets in Camden, in London, selling old Superstars. You've got the Japanese kind of collectors, vintage collectors buying up old stock. And you have people travelling around all of these
Because the shape has changed over the years. I mean, I've seen different versions of the Superstar, and you had sort of different licensed versions such as that. You had the Made in France ones and so on and so forth. It's a bit like the Made in Hugo Puma Suede. There's a different shape to those. All this is sort of like moving forward throughout the 90s. People are wearing shell toes, as you say, Thomas, like an everyday item. It was at the cusp of hot, cool fashion. Then it becomes part of the mainstream. But then Adidas had a bit of a problem with that, I think, which sort of led, to the 35th anniversary and what happened there.
What do you mean they had a problem with it, though?
With the fact that it wasn't cool, right? You see? Now, the thing is...
You can't tell me the Superstar was never cool.
but to retain, coolness, what Adidas did, again, to celebrate the 35th anniversary of this shoe was phenomenal.
Yeah, come on, it wasn't like it was not cool. It had been cool, and it was, it had gone through the 90s, it was associated with a lot of Britpop stuff, people were liking it.
Yeah, but the thing is, right, early 2000s, the dominant shoe was the Dunk SB, right? So it wasn't cool. The Superstar wasn't cool. There were some fanatics.
It shows you that these companies, they have to constantly, remind people and they go through these sort of cycles of marketing and selling stuff. Yeah, come on. The Superstar was just it got a little bit boring, perhaps. Mm. Perhaps that was the thing. It was just a little bit, everywhere.
Yeah.
The Superstar 35th stuff. I mean, the first academic thing that I wrote about sneakers was about the Adidas Superstar. I wrote an essay for my MA.
Mm.
And I wrote that at the same time as all the 35th stuff was going on. And partly it was because the 35th stuff, there was, like a website, which now would be probably very clunky, but had a lot of information about the history of the Superstar. And I was able to use some of that and find more things about the shoe and wrote this kind of historical thing about it. The thing I thought was interesting about that campaign...
It'd be great if you wrote a book about it, wouldn't it?
I know. I don't know.
with a certain someone that we're in conversation with right now.
Yeah. Who'd have ever thought of writing a book on sneakers? Who'd do something like that?
Only silly
so
people,
daft.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
daft.
Yeah.
But the thing about that 35th campaign, I mean, this is the thing that really gets me. It's the 35th. Like, I mean, whoever celebrates the 35th anniversary? I mean, is that a big anniversary?
No.
What's
not really.
That?
It's kind of one that you forget about.
Yeah, that was one of the ones that was just like, really? But anyway, everyone went with it, though.
Everyone went with it. It's quite interesting because it does... I think it really sets the scene for the development of sneaker culture that you've seen over the next sort of 15 years,
agreed.
Which is that you had a series of collaborations between Adidas and cool like streetwear brands or cool sort of sneaker stores, and you had these kind of collaborations with figures from pop music and art and everything like Missy Elliott or whoever.
You had Jay-Z, you had the Chili Peppers. You had all those kind of... Yeah, Ian Brown.
Yeah, Upper Playground, yeah. Ian Brown. And then the Lee Quinn Owens one, for me, Quinn Owens one is my favourite because Lee was just the Don Dada, New York graffiti artist. And for Adidas to recognise that was absolutely phenomenal. But there was a whole plethora. And then you also had the vintage line. So basically, Adidas... retooled and took it back to the essence of the shoe, if I'm not mistaken, and the collaborations that they had there, like with Foot Patrol, Union,
But this is the way it develops, is that you see them selling the shoe now, today, or in 2005 when this was happening, on the basis of cultural associations that it has developed over its lifetime. So they're selling the shoe on the fact that it was connected to hip hop, that it is connected to, Ian Brown. It connects you up with, Manchester music.
That's right.
You've got the kind of graffiti connection through Lee Quinones. You've got all of that stuff happening. You've got the Chili Peppers, it's connected to rock. You've got the sort of skateboarding thing going on with it. That whole thing is brought together in the Superstar 35th campaign. Mm. And the idea that you have a collaboration between two sort of either brands or, an individual and a brand, that whole thing, which hadn't started with the Superstar 35th, because before that there was the Bathing Ape Superstar that
yes.
kind of really taken it, you know, like taken that approach. And that was one of the first kind of collaborations that we'd really seen. That whole thing, that's what sets the scene for it. You've also got that thing as well with the idea that, you know, sneaker culture now is very much about, you know, limited drops and limited edition, this, that, and the other collaborations between people, kind of feeding people this, you know, a lot of product that's differentiated very slightly that encourages you to perhaps collect them all, you know, like it's a bit like, You must have 35 all 35
like,
of them.
It's like football stickers.
It is.
You
know?
It is. Which are now, you've got to collect them all,
Football stickers are now Pokemon cards, you know what I mean? It's that yeah. thing, isn't it, really? You know? Got need swap.
Yeah.
Right? I swap you a pair of neighbourhoods.
Yeah. Have you got a pair of the neighbourhoods?
No, I wish I had. I think they were the best ones of that whole
The neighbourhoods were
Apart from the one that was a sort of copy of the very first one, I think that was the one that I thought was
the Adidas one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With Adidas's.
You see, I find that one a bit odd, and especially after our conversation with Chris the Burn Kish, because it should have Chris's face on it.
Chris
and
Horse on one, and Chris's on the other. If they're going to do it,
Adidasler didn't even know about the shoe for a while, did he? Because Horse kept it secret, and yet his face ended up on the shoe.
There was no future in basketball shoes, is Adidasler, you know, and Gatti's line as well.
As much as we love him, as much as we love Adidasler, we should have another new edition with Chris's.
I dare say it, right? This is controversial. I think Horse Dassler is actually in the voyage of discovery that we've had on this show. I think Horst Dassler is the man that we have to credit for where we are.
I'm completely with you on that. I am completely with you. As controversial as that is.
What did Adi Dassler give us? Horst Dassler gave us innovation. Horst Dassler gave us some of the key models and for why we're at why we're here right now.
Well, Horst Dassler also, like, I mean, Adi Dassler was a genius in making sports shoes and he, you know, like, tailored his products really specifically to the needs of athletes. And he really invented the modern sports shoe. Like, you've got to give him credit for that.
Oh, well, no, we'll give him credit for that. But Horst Dassler
what Horst Dassler sees is he has the vision of this thing being a much bigger cultural phenomenon. And he has the idea that you can have this whole sports leisure type of thing. And he sees the way the market is going. And he tries to do it, but it doesn't really succeed. He's kind of too early at doing it. So in the 70s and 80s, where Adidas are producing stuff like, you know, the slightly boring kind of grandpa shoes that they made, which now everybody thinks are amazing. At the time, it was sort of a bit complicated and people didn't know what they were doing. They're like, hang on, you're a sports brand. Why are you making, like, woolly jumpers? Like, you know, why are you signing a deal with a rap group? Like, that whole stuff that people didn't quite get and was in the early 90s was sort of credited with the idea that Adidas had lost its way slightly because it had become too kind of, you know, too fragmented.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, if you look at what they have now, where you have these different lines, you've got an elite sports line, a fashion line, connections with Stella McCartney, like all the collaborations with like Jeremy Scott, like, and all those sort of people. It's there's an old school, you know, like Spezial stuff, which is much like, you know, a kind of fashion led line. Like all of that.
And they got Y3 as well, which was a very pioneering concept.
All of that stuff.
Very brave initiative.
All of that stuff, which has developed since the late 90s, that really is putting into practice the vision that Horst Dassler had in the 70s and 80s.
I think Horst is, he's almost like the Steve Jobs of the sneaker business. That's how I call him, because he was so way ahead of his time. And as you say, at that time, a lot of people thought, you know, why is he doing all this? Yet we're all doing it now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, doing something that we don't think we need. And then he gives it to you and you're like, oh, facepalm.
Exactly.
Yeah, we do need it. You know what I mean? It's like apparent and it just seems like, you know, second nature now that we're in there. You know, the remarkable thing about the 35th, though, the 35th anniversary of the Superstar, in terms of marketing, in terms of the whole concept, you know, the way everything teared down, as we've discussed, it kicked Nike up the arse. Do you know what I mean?
It really
kicked them up the butt, because the thing is, the Nike Powerwall thing happened after that. You remember when they had all different Air Maxes and they had all different partners and blah, 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 blah.
Okay. Yeah.
The exact direct replica of it. And you had the BRS version, you had the Lemonades and so on and so forth. And, you know, some of the most desirable models and executions of those.
I thought it was a really influential campaign, that 35th campaign, because you saw, you know, other brands basically copying the same approach. And so you'd have a sort of, you know, sort of a little bit of history about certain shoes. So you sort of Air Force Ones, perhaps, you sort of Puma Clydes, a lot of the Nike stuff that came out afterwards. Mm-hmm. That's right. Kind of that whole idea.
Good shout, Air Force One 25th anniversary campaign.
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly. Yeah. So some of this stuff was coming out around the same time, and they were just kind of realizing that there was this thing called sort of sneaker culture, which had been there all the way through, but was actually something that they could perhaps use to perhaps sell to a wider market. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about Superstar 35th is that it builds on kind of the connections with sort of sneaker culture in the form of like these kind of niche boutiques that are selling sneakers, like with the whole retro thing that people knew about, all that kind of stuff, to basically make and sell. Some of the models were pretty kind of inexpensive, just relatively sort of everyday shoes. There was like different product levels, weren't there, in the
That's
whole
right.
range.
That's right.
And they used that, the connection with sort of a small group of kind of consumers, knowledgeable consumers, sneakerhead consumers, to kind of perhaps sell it to a kind of wider audience. So you've got some of those, the city ones, like the New Yorks or the Dublin and stuff, were very, very basic models, really, relatively inexpensive models compared to, say, the premium ones that were some of those, you know, the connections with like Neighborhood or something.
They were entry level, and to get you involved, you know, with aspirations, I guess.
It's to bring it in, and it's that idea of having kind of borrowing some of the cool. I mean, that's the great thing about the collaboration is that you combine between two brands, but you borrow some of the cool from one of the other brands, and then that, you know, reflects well upon Adidas. So Adidas,
the sum is greater than the parts. As we've discussed, the Superstar, a great canvas for collaborations. Which is your favourite?
My favourite, I mean, I think that Neighbourhood one that came out the 35th, that's probably one of the best ones, I think, ever, of all the collaborations.
Even over the Bape one that came out just prior?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, I'm fairly boring, really. I just like the standard stuff. I would say the stuff that I think is really interesting and really exciting at the moment is people like Bluntshank making custom, like handmade, luxury sort of bespoke superstars for people. Like something that Adidas is not doing. Like he's out there crafting as a shoemaker these, you know, beautiful handmade shoes based on like this kind of, you know, template that was formed by Adidas many years before. And I think some of the shoes that he's making are really the ones that make my kind of, you know, mind boggle, because I think that's interesting. You know, like I talk about Adidas with students, like I use the Superstar in lectures as a really good example of a product that has kind of shifted in the way we think about it and how it's taken on it's taken on meanings, and the way we kind of approach it and consider it is completely different to how it was initially envisaged. So when Chris Severn was creating this shoe, he had absolutely no conception 50 years later somebody would be hand-making luxury versions of the shoe that he was designing, like outside of Adidas's connection.
It would be great if Adidas could actually do one. I remember them doing a Kegler Super years ago out of ostrich leather. It cost a horrendous amount of money, but I think it was made in their German factory, and it was a beautiful thing. And it'd be great to see, you know, Adidas teaming up. They have teamed up with Hender Scheme, but not with the Superstar. And with other models, so
I think it's interesting though that you've got people saying, I want an entirely bespoke, a one-off version of this shoe. I'm going to pick everything that I want on it, and I'm going to get this guy to make it. You know, and he's, you know, lovely kind of threads and leathers and all that stuff, and it's completely handmade. It's nothing like a Superstar. Like a Superstar is a mass-produced shoe that's churned out of a factory that's all kind of the same. This is a one-off individual thing. And I think it's interesting the way that you've got this product.
It's like the Adidas Megastar.
The Megastar.
The Megastar. We've had the Superstar, the Ultrastar. I'm waiting for the Adidas Megastar. This is the Adidas Megastar.
I know. Why did they not bring that out? That should have come out in about 1989 or something.
They did. They can send me a check for that one as well.
Thomas, talking about those customs, I mean, when we were talking to Chris yesterday, it's quite interesting because in a way, it's kind of gone full circle. Because originally, you know, Chris was telling us that, you know, he only had about 10 pairs to give out to players, you know, and they were almost made on a bespoke basis. So I kind of like the fact that, you know, it's the 50th anniversary. We've almost gone round full circle.
Yeah, those initial shoes were ones that they would have made. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? That they were making them for athletes or for a sort of group of them, and they were, and especially when they were developing it, that you had people who knew how to make shoes and work the machines and work with leather and everything to make a shoe. And that's going back to the traditions that someone like Adi Dassler and Horst Dassler was schooled in.
Yeah.
And how to make...
Yes, that DNA is still threading through, which is remarkable. Younger listeners will be, will acutely remember what Pharrell did with the Superstar. And I have to say, that was another groundbreaking moment.
The multicoloured sneakers, like just the whole... color palette. I mean, it's groundbreaking, and it's a continuation of like other things that we've seen. So it's like of the Run-DMC thing. So it does have roots, and yet you've got this constant. I think that's the thing about the Superstar and other shoes like the Stan Smith or some of the kind of Nike Air Force One or something, where they are becoming these sort of classic shoes that are endlessly sort of, you know, you can play around with them and provide people with a blank canvas, and they can be endlessly reinterpreted. And they've become, it's interesting the way that certain sort of designs and models have just become fixed, and that is those are the sort of pillars of sort of sneaker culture.
That's right.
And Superstar is definitely one of them that is always going to kind of be there, in the same way that, if you know, like, you know, when I was talking previously, we were talking about the history of shoes going back to the 19th century. Some of them, you know, you've got certain shoe styles which are based on like 19th century shoe styles, which are still the shoes that you wear today. And those shoes, those designs have been endlessly kind of tweaked and reshaped and altered, and are still relevant today. And I think that's kind of happening with some of these sneaker models, Superstar, Air Force One, Stan Smith, Air Max One, perhaps.
Well, that's a great way to leave things, isn't it, really, on that one? Jason's got a few questions from our listeners.
We do indeed. Well, unfortunately, you've just answered one of those from Matt Baker.
Ask me again.
Yeah. So from Matt Baker, which is your favourite pair of Superstars ever? And don't be so vague this time, Thomas.
My favourite... hang on, that's different. That's a different question.
Uh-huh. Okay.
My favourite collaboration, that's a collaboration. My favourite pair of Superstars, these are the ones that I've had, right? I mean, I've had loads of pairs of Superstars. I was thinking before we did this, I was thinking, what pairs of Superstars have I had? I had a pair of white and blue ones that I used to wear, and I eventually wore them when I worked in a crisp factory, and they got impregnated with prawn cocktail flavouring dust.
Oh, no.
They smelled really bad.
Oh, what a tragic demise.
That was a sad and sorry end for that pair.
Oh, my God.
But I actually did my final university exam for my, you know, from when I did my first degree. I did my final examination in a pair of black and white Adidas Superstars. And I remember wearing them because we had to wear a special sort of get-up for doing exams. Like, you had to wear a suit and a bow tie and all this kind of nonsense. That's what happens. Yeah. Okay. And you were supposed to wear shoes. You were supposed to wear black shoes. And I remember going in the first exams and I was wearing shoes and a suit and a bow tie. I was like, what am I doing? This is crazy. And then for the ones afterwards, I needed something a bit more comfortable that I felt a bit more at ease in. So I wore my black and white Superstars. I think that's probably my favourite pair that I ever had.
Is there a picture of you in that get-up?
Yeah, probably.
We'd love to see
it. Yeah, probably.
We've got to see that. Yeah. It's got to go in a book if it ever happens as well.
In the pod afterwards. Definitely.
Cool. Yeah. And then the next one is from Shell Toe Sucker, which a great name. Love that. If you could do your own Superstar collaboration, your very own, who would it be with?
Oh, God. What, me and someone to collaborate with on a Superstar?
Exactly, yeah.
I would collaborate with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and ask him about like what he really liked.
Good choice.
About them. Yeah,
that's a fantastic choice, because he played in that shoe more than his signature model, right?
He did, and he's a very, you know, like, he's a very learned man, and I think he would be an interesting person to talk to about this kind of thing.
Definitely.
And what he would come up with.
No.
Well, you know, that's a good one. Well, Thomas, man, you know what I mean? That was brilliant, man. I'm, you know, into the deepest recesses of your mind, pulling out these gems. Do you know what I mean? It's absolutely wicked, man.
Pleasure
to speak, as
always.
And I think we'll be chatting with you even more. Ain't that right, Jace?
I'm sure we will. Absolutely.
I hope so.
Fantastic. Cheers, Thomas. Thanks for coming on again.
Thank you. Woo! Wow. Jace, man, that's it for another episode, mate. That was absolutely wicked, wasn't it, having a little chat with old Thomas right there?
He always gives us gold, doesn't he, Thomas? He's brilliant.
Dr. Thomas Turner, PhD. You know what I mean? He's brilliant. You know what I mean? He's, like, got the most dramatic, like, name that we could ever have on this show, I think. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, thanks very much for everyone listening in. And remember to send your questions to us on Twitter or Instagram at soulful_podcast. You can follow myself, Kish, at KishCash1, and Jace at MadeByJace.
And don't forget to subscribe, and if you like this podcast, please leave us a very nice review. See you next time.